John Johnson Sr. says Tiffany's statements were false and a direct attack on tribal sovereignty and treaty rights. The tribe says it remains committed to working with local, state, and federal officials to resolve road access issues in a way that respects residents' safety and laws governing Indian lands. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The Arctic continues to warm faster than other parts of the world and is experiencing record high temperatures and record low levels of sea ice. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which released a report card for the region in December. Ayolna Naiden reports those findings directly affect indigenous communities.
The Arctic report card has been documenting changes in snow and sea ice cover, as well as air and ocean temperatures in the northern part of the globe for the past 20 years. It has shown that in that time, the Arctic's annual temperature has increased at more than double the global rate of temperature changes. Hannah Marie Ladd is the director of Indigenous Sentinels Network.
These changes cascade directly into people's lives, affecting fisheries, coastal safety, and subsistence harvests. We are no longer just documenting warming. We are witnessing an entire marine ecosystem, which is tied to our economies and culture, transform within a single generation.
The report highlights an emerging phenomenon called rusting rivers. Permafrost thaw causes groundwater to seep deeper and interact with mineral deposits, which turns some streams and rivers to a rusty orange color. Abigail Pruitt says that in Alaska, over 200 streams turned orange in recent years.
Within Kobuk Valley National Park, we observed the complete loss of juvenile Dolly Varden and Slimy Sculpin in a tributary to the Akilik River when it turned orange. Beyond the effects on fish, rusting rivers may impact drinking water supplies to rural communities.
The report highlights how Indigenous communities have been observing the changes in the environment and wildlife and collaborating with scientists to better understand those changes. Ladd, with the Indigenous Sentinels Network, describes one example of such work. St. Paul residents collect samples of harvested traditional foods, like seabirds, marine mammals, and halibut. Those samples are tested in a tribally owned lab and analyzed for contaminants like mercury.
Indigenous leadership, local workforce development, and community-driven observing are not optional. They are essential to understanding the Arctic that we have today and preparing for the Arctic we are moving into.
I am Alona Naiden.
So glad to have you with us on the KBOO Evening News for this Thursday, February 26, 2026.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Josh Salem, and Isabel Charlet.
The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto.
Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Oregon Arts Watch Executive Director Laura Grimes to talk about some of the latest arts news in our region. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for being here, for taking the time. So let's get into it. One of the stories we wanted to talk about today is called D.E. May's Postcards from Island Salem, Not What Art Means, But What It Does. And this is by David Bates. That title does not betray a ton of what this actual article is about, but you're going to explain it to us. So let's go there.
D.E. May is a noted Northwest artist who has a major retrospective exhibit at the Hallie Ford Museum of Art in Salem. Hallie Ford is part of Willamette University. But before I talk about May's exhibit, I want to give a little background about the museum, just because there's some interesting things going on there. The Halle Ford Museum was founded in 1998, so it's a little more than 25 years old, not quite 30, which is remarkably young in museum years. But it's an important pillar in the Northwest visual arts ecology, because the museum's central mission is to showcase Northwest artists. And it's one of the only museums in the Northwest that focuses exclusively on regional art in this area. The Bellevue Arts Museum in the Seattle area had a similar focus, but in September 2024, it announced it was closing, and it's now in receivership. So the Halle Ford Museum carries an important torch for local artists. John Olbrant, the director of the Halle Ford, has led the museum since it was founded. So he's built a remarkable museum in that time that has a sterling reputation for quality and academic rigor. Many of the exhibits come with gorgeous catalogs and essays that serve to educate, expand the knowledge of the exhibits, and leave a lasting impact. And all of that serves a very important role in the critical conversations around visual arts. You know, what does it mean? How does that mean for our lives and society, and how does that work? What are the conversations happening around visual arts? So Halle Ford plays a very important role in that in the Northwest and in Oregon and in the Salem area. Olbrant's announced that he's retiring later in 2026, so he leaves a remarkable legacy and some mighty big shoes to fill. It will be interesting what the next chapter looks like for the Halle Ford Museum. So getting back to D.E. May's exhibit, D.E. May was born, raised, and lived almost his entire life in the Salem area. He was born in Kaiser, and he lived in Salem, where the Halle Ford Museum is located. And May died of cancer in 2019, and this exhibit pays tribute to his long artistic career. So Linda Tessner curated the exhibit, and the opening line of her essay in the catalog reads, "How can an object be simultaneously familiar yet inexplicably enigmatic, like a faded memory or an ungraspable longing?" And so I think that describes May's artwork really well. His work is warm and has a vintage vibe to it. He works a lot with wood and cardboard, colors a lot of natural colors like browns and cream colors, you know, off kind of colors that sort of have this faded texture to them. It looks old and settled. And he did a lot of work that had a lot of geometric shapes in it. The straight lines and it's just kind of, I wanted to say, deceptively simple. Sometimes, you know, they were squares or rectangles, but there was this craftsmanship to it that was always somehow, to me, it was kind of tactile in a way. You can see the process of him creating it. So there's something for me, there was like this quietness to it, something that you want to spend time with and think about. So David Bates, who wrote the story, describes the exhibit as having a refreshing analog vibe, which I also really appreciate, because there's it just kind of looks like it's from a throwback era or something. And May himself once said that, and I'm going to quote this here, "A number of years ago, a musician was in my workroom holding one of my constructions in his hands and commented, 'It looks like it has always been this way.' And D.E. May says, 'I carry that observation with me like a compass.'" And so that, you know, it feels like it's always been this way. And his works kind of, they seem like that. They seem like they've just sort of settled into themselves. And this is what he's creating out of construction, cardboard, you know, wood, and just whatever he finds. He spent a lot of time since he lived in Salem. He lived on Ferry Street near a paper mill along the Willamette River that used to be one of the city's largest employers. So he'd often find discarded cardboard and faded and stained paper and pieces of wood and whatever flotsam and ephemera he could find. And so he would use these found objects in his work all the time. So it's kind of a rare chance to see the scope of his work that spanned his artistic career. And the exhibit of D.E. May's work runs through March 21st at the Hallie Ford Museum in Salem.
There's a quote in Bates's article, or like a paragraph that I found really kind of grabbed me. I might quote it to you if that's okay. It reads, quote, "Regardless of whether it's a grid sprawling across a wall, an enigmatic sculpture, or one of May's collages, mixed media works, or drawings, virtually all the pieces in the exhibition get to the heart, I think, not of what art, quote-unquote, means, but what it does. It yanks the viewer out of the practical means and ends thinking in which we regard everything as having a function, and takes us out of ourselves in a way that enriches the imagination."
Yeah, that's really good. And I loved how you described the artwork a little bit. The exhibit has anything from like big works that spread across walls to teeny tiny postcards. Apparently, he was really known for creating these little postcards, and he would mail them to people. So the exhibit has a number of those. It has some drawers that are full of the postcards that he created. So, you know, kind of nice to think of it in both expansive terms and little tiny things that he would create.
Also, we should mention what Island Salem is. Do you want to explain that?
Oh, yeah. I love that phrase. It was his term for Salem. It was kind of his own personal term for how he described, you know, where he lived, since he spent most of his life in Salem. He called it Island Salem.
And there's an exhibit of his work happening in Portland as of right now, right?
Oh, yes, there is. I think it's at PDX Contemporary. Yeah, in fact, they have done a number of his exhibits over the years. I've noted they had a long-time relationship, and so they've had a several. So yeah, there's kind of these two opportunities to see May's work, one in Portland right now, and then this bigger retrospective in Salem. So it's kind of nice to have both of them kind of, you know, kind of have their own conversation going.
Well, another article I wanted to ask you about is also by David Bates. It's called McMinnville Short Film Festival, Tiny Budget, Small Crews, Big Impact. The four-day festival starts Thursday and will screen nearly 100 films from 15 countries.
Yeah, the McMinnville Short Film Festival is, I think it's in its 15th year. It's kind of started small and it's grown bigger and bigger. It's grown beyond its founders now and has its executive, this new executive director who's been there for a couple of years. It's been fun to see it grow over the years. And it's important to recognize that the impact that these film festivals have. I mean, Oregon does have some film festivals around the state. Panorama will be in its second year. I believe it has a film festival in April this year. It kind of took the mantle from the Portland International Film Festival and then, you know, recreated its own version. And so that's happening. And then there are also film festivals in Bend and in LaGrande. It's called the Eastern Oregon Film Festival. Ashland, I think Klamath Falls has had one. I can't remember if it's been consistent, but so there are a few, but this particular one in McMinnville is a short film festival, so everything is less than 30 minutes. It averages, usually the films average around 15 minutes. And it's just a really important outlet for film creators. And some of these films are, you know, major contenders for big awards. They really have a quality of films available to see. People submit them from all over, and then they make a decision of what films to show. So there's a whole sort of juried process there. And it's nice to see that this is growing. It's growing in popularity and some of the shows sell out. And so the McMinnville Short Film Festival runs February 26th through March 1st.
If our listeners are interested in reading these stories for themselves or all the Oregon Arts Watch news, where can they find out more?
You find all these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate being here.
That was Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest arts news from our region. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Two major defeats for Trump's tariffs. Trump will discuss arms sales to Taiwan with Xi Jinping. And the U.S. to build an alternative, costly global health network. Two major defeats for Trump's tariffs. The Supreme Court finally weighed in on Trump's tariffs. By a 6-3 margin, the court disallowed tariffs that Trump had tried to justify on the basis of a 1977 emergency trade law that doesn't even use the word tariffs. The court's decision invalidates tariffs for around 1/4 of all imports to the U.S., those from about 20 countries, plus the European Union. It could lead to a good deal of chaos in international business circles at home as questions arise about repayment to businesses and consumers for what amount to taxes on imported goods. The government has collected over $200 billion in tariff revenue since Trump imposed high tariffs. Will any of that be refunded? The chaos extends to business and governments abroad. Should they adhere to existing trade agreements? What comes next with the always unpredictable Trump? India, Indonesia, Japan, and South Korea all made significant concessions to the U.S. to get lower tariffs, only to find that had they waited, they would have gotten a better deal without having to promise huge investments in the U.S. or tariff-free imports of U.S. products. By the way, the across-the-board tariffs announced by Trump were set at 10%, then announced as 15% a day later, only to be held off for now. It's the kind of unpredictability characteristic of Trump. Trump railed against the court majority, which included the Chief Justice. He called the decision a disgrace, said those who ruled against him were disloyal, and suggested that the court was in bed with foreign countries. He made clear immediately after news of the court's decision reached him that, quote, I can do anything I want. Perhaps he can. He has plenty of options under existing trade law, though that won't prevent new lawsuits and probably won't reduce the prices of many basic commodities, such as steel and aluminum. There's more to come. A second defeat for Trump's tariffs is the news that they have failed to accomplish the aim of a sharp reduction in the U.S. trade deficit. Instead, the deficit went down only 0.2% in 2025 compared with 2024, a record $1.2 trillion. Trump claimed it went down 78%, a figure he erroneously plucked out of a single month's reduction. Including services along with goods, the U.S. trade deficit was still over $900 billion last year, based on exports of $3.4 trillion and imports of $4.3 trillion. Although the trade deficit with China declined considerably, with a 30% reduction in Chinese imports, U.S. imports from other Asian countries, such as Vietnam and Taiwan, more than made up for that. Trump will discuss arms sales to Taiwan with Xi Jinping. U.S. arms sales to Taiwan are a pillar of China policy in two ways. First, the sales, such as the most recent one for a whopping $11 billion, are critical to Taiwan's ability to deter a Chinese attack. Second, the sales are not a matter of discussion with China. Yet here is Trump saying, in anticipation of his visit to China in April, quote, "I'm talking to him, Xi Jinping, about it. We had a good conversation, and we'll make a determination pretty soon." We? Added that he has a, quote, "very good relationship with President Xi." Of course. But Trump is mindful that in his last telephone conversation with Xi, Xi warned that U.S. arms sales to Taiwan must be handled with, quote, "prudence." If Trump essentially gives China a veto over those sales, it won't leave Taiwan defenseless. There are plenty of other arms suppliers, and Taiwan is significantly increasing its arms spending. But it will be the worst nightmare, abandonment by the United States. The shock effect on Taiwan's morale will give China's pressure for unification a sizable boost. Any limitation of arms sales to Taiwan ordinarily would have to be set by Congress, since congressional law in 1979 obligates the U.S. to supply Taiwan with arms for defense. The U.S. to build an alternative, costly global health network. In place of the World Health Organization, from which the U.S. has withdrawn, and the Agency for International Development, which the Trump administration has dismantled, the administration is proposing its own global disease network at a cost of around $2 billion a year, or three times what it cost the U.S. previously. According to the Washington Post, the administration, quote, would recreate systems such as laboratories, data-sharing networks, and rapid response systems the U.S. abandoned under the World Health Organization and AID. At that time, the U.S. was paying around 15% of the World Health Organization's budget. Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Health and Human Services Department will take this project on. International health experts questioned this move by the administration, quote, "Spending two to three times the cost to create what we already had access to makes absolutely no sense in terms of fiscal stewardship," said Tom Inglesby, a former advisor to Joe Biden, now at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. "The administration's plan cannot have the reach or influence of the World Health Organization with respect either to governments or non-governmental organizations. Moreover, this administration plan comes too late to save lives already lost by the U.S. withdrawal. Upward of 750,000 lives, according to Atul Gawande, USAID's former Assistant Administrator for Global Health." In other news, Trump's latest intervention in Greenland fails. We all knew that just because Trump reached an agreement with Denmark on security cooperation in Greenland, that wouldn't be the end of the story. His latest attempt to force his way on Greenland was his offer to send a hospital ship there to, quote, "take care of the many people who are sick and not being taken care of there," adding that the ship was on the way. The Danes had other ideas. They rejected the visit and reminded Trump that Greenlanders, like all Danes, but not Americans, have access to free health care. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen of Denmark did not need to mention Trump or the United States in saying, quote, "I'm happy to live in a country where there is free and equal access to health care for everyone. The same approach exists in Greenland," she said. She might also have informed Trump that the hospital ship is actually in dry dock. As NATO focuses on Arctic defense, China and Russia coordinate research in the Arctic. The news about NATO's security concerns in the Arctic come as China's interests in the Arctic increase. Newsweek reports that China is paying Russia hundreds of thousands of dollars to join its scientific expeditions to the Arctic. China's presence on Russian ships was disclosed to Newsweek by Chinese researchers and officials at a research conference in the Arctic Circle in early February in Norway. Newsweek was one of the only Western media outlets present at the Chinese event. A Chinese researcher told Newsweek that although the Russians have denied China a bid to establish a research center along Russia's Arctic coast, the two countries have held four joint expeditions in the Arctic since 2016, gathering mineral samples. Donald Trump votes for Viktor Orban. Trump is not shy about meddling in other countries' politics. He stumped for Bolsonaro in Brazil, Netanyahu in Israel, Milei in Argentina, and Mark Carney's opponent in Canada, among others. Last week, Trump offered a ringing endorsement of Viktor Orban's re-election in Hungary, saying, quote, "Highly respected Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, is a truly strong and powerful leader with a proven track record of delivering phenomenal results. He fights tirelessly for and loves his great country and people, just like I do. Viktor works hard to protect Hungary, grow the economy, create jobs, promote trade, stop illegal immigration, and ensure law and order," in capital letters. Trump vowed to strengthen U.S.-Hungary relations. Marco Rubio just visited Orban to plug his candidacy. Orban's autocratic regime has already been in office 16 years. Trump again criticizes the British handover of the Chagos Islands. President Trump criticized the United Kingdom's impending handover of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius as a big mistake, insisting that the U.S. might need the airbase on Diego Garcia in the Chagos for future airstrikes against Iran if Iran should fail to agree to a nuclear deal. "Decide not to make a deal," said Trump. "It may be necessary for the U.S. to use Diego Garcia to eradicate a potential attack by a highly unstable and dangerous regime." A few weeks ago, Trump said that Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer had committed an, quote, "act of great stupidity" for deciding that the Chagos Islands would be handed over to Mauritius on a 99-year lease arrangement. It now appears that Britain is blocking the U.S. from use of the base for an attack on Iran, which accounts for Trump's criticism of Britain. But get this, the State Department issued a statement that clearly expressed U.S. support for Britain's handover. Someone evidently had failed to bring state into the loop. Next, who needs Canada? Trump may bypass renewing the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. The New York Times is reporting that Trump is considering not including Canada in the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement that is shortly up for renewal. Despite the great costs to American businesses that carving Canada out of the agreement would create, Trump is evidently so piqued with Canada and its Prime Minister Mark Carney that he's willing to sacrifice a huge trade relationship. The U.S. ambassador to Israel endorses Israel's control of the Middle East. In an interview with the far-right commentator Tucker Carlson, U.S. ambassador to Israel and Christian evangelical Mike Huckabee was asked whether Israel had the right to control a greater Israel spanning what he described as basically the entire Middle East, to which Huckabee replied that, quote, "it would be fine if they took it all." Huckabee also said Israel was, quote, "a land that God gave through Abraham." And when Carlson asked whether that territory extended from the Nile River to the Euphrates, Huckabee replied, "I'm not sure it would go that far. It would be a big piece of land." The Palestinian Authority condemned Huckabee's remarks as provocative and unacceptable, while Jordan and the Arab League described them as a violation of established diplomatic norms. The Palestinian Authority urged the Trump administration to denounce the ambassador's remarks for undermining efforts for a lasting peace in the region. Jordan said that Huckabee's comments contradicted Trump's declared position against Israeli annexation of the West Bank. Don't count on Trump to contradict Huckabee. The death of a far-right man in France creates turmoil. In a situation reminiscent of the killing of Charlie Kirk, a young far-right activist, Quentin Durant, was killed in a brawl in Lyon, apparently by several far-left individuals. 11 people have been arrested and 2 have been charged with murder. Far-right demonstrations in honor of the slain activist have taken place across France. CNN reports that, quote, "French sociologists tracking militant political violence say the vast majority of incidents in recent decades have been caused by far-right and neo-Nazi groups. The government has disbanded 3 far-right groups so far and 1 far-left group. But this incident may help the far-right National Rally Party win the presidency for the first time in national elections next year. As one French analyst wrote, quote, a kind of landslide occurred with the death of Quentin Durant. The French unbowed leftist party became the most criticized, both politically and in the media. The Trump administration and the Italian government were quick to step in, citing left-wing violence as the reason for Durant's death. The State Department posted that, quote, violent radical leftism is on the rise, and its role in Quentin Durant's death demonstrates the threat it poses to public safety. We will continue to monitor the situation and expect to see the perpetrators of violence brought to justice, unquote. No mention of far-right violence. France summoned the U.S. ambassador, Charles Kushner, yes, that Kushner, to protest the State Department's comments, but he didn't show up. Now Kushner is barred by the French government from contact with any French ministries. Finally, the real U.S. prize in the Ukraine war, Russian resources. Donald Trump's only concern about the war in Ukraine is that it end ASAP in order for him to win the peace, that is, a supposed $12 trillion worth of deals with Russia. As The Economist reports, quote, in Europe, fears are rising that President Trump could force Ukraine into crippling concessions by June, his latest deadline for peace, to chase gold in Russia. Of course, those fears are also Ukraine's nightmare. President Zelensky knows that nothing matters to Trump so much as a big deal. The Economist reports that, quote, America has been offered deals for Arctic oil and gas, rare earth mines, a nuclear-powered data center, and a tunnel under the Bering Strait. Both sides stand to benefit. Russia is suffering from low oil prices and stricter sanctions, and America's president wants results before the November midterm elections. Nevertheless, most American businesses, around 1,500 of them that once operated in Russia, remain leery of returning to that country. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertoff. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation.